Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Friday, the 19th of January, 2018. I'm Joe Vicnicki with the local news. Alaska Governor Bill Walker called on the state legislature to take action on a long-term budget plan for the state. In his annual State of the State address last night, speaking for nearly an hour, he said lawmakers should pass next year's budget within the 90-day session set by state law.
Any system that cannot deliver a budget within 90 legislative days is broken. And anyone that can't see that or refuses to address it is complicit in that failure. Passing a budget on time is not complicated. Other states do it on time, so can we.
Walker has called for daily payments to cover legislators' expenses to be cut off and for their salaries to be withheld if lawmakers miss that budget deadline. He repeated his call for a 1.5% tax on income from employment for 3 years. The state would use the money to pay for maintenance work on state roads and facilities throughout the state. Walker said the natural gas pipeline he's long championed is needed for residents and for state revenue.
Jobs, low-cost energy for Alaskan homes and businesses, clean air, and a healthy economy all across the state are what's at stake.
Walker said the presidents of both the U.S. and China have a vested interest in developing that pipeline. The governor stressed the effects of climate change evident throughout Alaska. He said the state must address them in the context of a resource extraction economy. Walker has asked a task force to make recommendations on climate change by September.
Retreating sea ice and glaciers and thawing permafrost are not partisan issues. They are social, environmental, and economic ones.
Republican lawmakers reacted coolly to the speech by Walker, an independent. Kenai Republican Representative Gary Knopp says Walker used too much of the speech to criticize the legislature for inaction.
I don't appreciate the opportunity to take the State of the State address and chastise the legislature because we have philosophical differences on the budget and where we should go. You know, legislature is not flawless. We do play more partisan politics than we should, but not the time or the place for that particular topic.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat, says it was fair for Walker or anyone else to express frustration for the legislature's past failure to compromise, but Edgman says he's optimistic the House and Senate will pass a plan this year. Widespread fishing restrictions on Southeast Alaska king salmon could be decided as early as today, with the Alaska Board of Fisheries reconvening in Sitka. Board Chair John Jensen of Petersburg didn't tip his hand on how far the restrictions could be when he gaveled out yesterday.
It's a work in progress right now. I think there are several board members that are trying to develop some language to deal with the action plans, and it's just a work in progress.
This week, the board heard from commercial fishermen, charter business owners, and others concerned about the dwindling stocks of kings, or Chinook salmon. Fish and game biologists testified that survival is poor, meaning fish aren't returning from the open ocean. The population is at an all-time low, and stocks cannot support fishing activity traditionally seen. Fish and Game's action plans give the board a few options. They can take no action, order unprecedented closures across southeast fishing districts, or something in between. That middle ground is favored by most fishermen. Sitka-based fisherman Tad Fujioka appealed to the board against blanket closures.
This 3 to 4 month regional closure that's contemplated in the action plans are very blunt tools. As an alternative, we can use a surgical approach that will allow us to catch the non-stock of concern kings when their value is highest in the winter and spring.
The board could delay action as late as next week when its 13-day meeting wraps up on Tuesday. New fees for cruise ship passengers and senior citizens got the first of three approvals by the Petersburg Borough Assembly this week. Elected officials are seeking to recoup some of the money from visitors to the area, along with seniors who use an exemption from the borough's 6% sales tax. Here's more in this report. While the new fees are not expected to bring in big money for the borough, assembly members see them as one step for increasing revenue for the municipality. One would be charged to seniors who use an exemption from the borough's sales tax. It would be an administrative fee to cover the cost of using those exemption cards. Marge Oinas was one of a few local residents testifying on the topic.
I could afford to pay $50 a year to keep that, but I'd rather not have to.
A draft ordinance puts the annual charge at $60. However, Assemblymember Nancy Strand moved to amend that to $100.
I think that we should be probably charging more like $100 just because the cost is going to go up and down. That's the only problem I have with it.
The amendment passed 5-1 with Mayor Mark Jensen the only no vote. The borough's finance director, Jody Tao, calculated the $60 amount by figuring out how much it cost the borough to issue the exemption cards and then dividing up that cost among most, but not all, of the 554 seniors who have an exemption card. Tao estimated that 400 of the seniors would not seek a low-income waiver. The draft ordinance would waive the fee for seniors living on less than $20,000 a year. That was a part that Assemblymember Jay Stanton Greger wanted to highlight.
I think it's that critical to take care of our most vulnerable population, so I wanted to really let people at home know that part is kind of wired into this.
But the new fee did not have unanimous support. Mayor Jensen remained opposed to the increase.
I won't be voting in favor of this because of the raise in the fee. The $60 fee was going to cover the cost, and I consider the extra $40 to be similar to a tax.
Jensen was the only vote against the senior fee in its first reading. If 400 seniors pay a $100 fee, that would bring in $40,000 a year for the borough. Along with local property tax, sales tax is one of the main sources of revenue that pays for basic services in the borough's general fund, which includes the borough's administration, police and fire protection, library and recreation departments, among others. The borough estimates it's losing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in sales tax because of that senior exemption. A second fee would charge $5 for each passenger on cruise ships visiting the borough. A draft ordinance was based on a similar charge in Juneau. The smaller cruise ships visiting Petersburg bring a few thousand passengers, though, not the million passengers other ports see in the summertime. And Petersburg's proposed fee is expected to raise at most around $35,000 a year. Assembly members hope to hear some input from cruise companies. Here's Kurt Wallheater.
I think if we do pass this in its first reading, I don't think it would be a bad idea to tell them that we're entertaining this thing, and you know, and they have a chance to comment on it. Because if they say we're not coming to town, then if that's the case, because we're getting hit everywhere around Southeast, we might want to reconsider this, you know, because we don't want Main Street to lose the business here just for a lousy $5 a head, you know, on a boat that carries 30 people, you know. I mean, so it just, you know, it wouldn't make sense. It would seem like it'd be counterintuitive. So
the money would go into a special revenue fund, and the Assembly would approve spending from that fund during the annual budgeting process. The vote was 6-0 to approve that cruise passenger fee. Both ordinances will have second readings and public hearings at the Assembly's first meeting next month. Both won't go into effect until January of next year if they're approved. The Southeast Public Radio Consortium Coast Alaska is acquiring Wrangell's, a local station, KSTK. That move is an effort by both parties to keep the station on the air in the face of increased funding challenges on both the state and national level. June Leffler has more on that story from Wrangell.
To receive federal funding, community broadcasters like KSTK have to bring in a certain amount of local, grant, and state monies. But in the past few years, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has made it a little harder for stations to secure that money. It raised the threshold to $300,000, and KSTK has been short the past 2 years.
The thing that's challenging in Alaska is that our communities are small, and a lot of our service is very local and robust locally, but it doesn't scale to large stations across the nation.
Molly Kabler is the executive director of Coast Alaska.
I think the vision or the idea from CPB was that if you weren't raising a significant amount of money from non-federal sources, you might not be valued by the people using your service.
The CPB contributes about one-third of KSTK's annual revenue, $120,000. Like all other public radio, the rest comes from the state and from local support, like memberships, pledge drives, and underwriting. For a small station like Wrangell's, it can be hard to expect a community of less than 3,000 people to donate hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And state funding is not making up the difference. Along with most public spending in Alaska, there have been consistent cuts to public broadcasting. Since 2015, KSTK's state funding has dropped 40% to $80,000 a year. KSTK leadership considered many options to keep the station afloat. One was to merge with KFSK in Petersburg, but that would ultimately be a hit for both stations, says KSTK's general manager Cindy Sweat.
There would be a little less local here and a little less local there. You know, they don't want to listen to our community calendar necessarily. We don't want to listen to their assembly meeting necessarily.
Sweat also says that consolidating the two stations would result in just one CPB and state grant for the two communities. Part of the answer was already in place. Both KSTK and KFSK are founding members of Coast Alaska, which handles their payroll and business administration and does the same for public stations in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. It was Kabler who suggested that Coast Alaska acquire KSTK. KSTK could run the station as it currently does, but it also could count on Coast Alaska's non-federal funds to help meet the CPB benchmark. In some ways, the move felt like the best way to protect KSTK's future and to preserve its independent sound.
Coast Alaska is a collaboration around the business and support around fundraising and engineering, but it's not a collaboration of content per se. Each station chooses the programming on the station that best serves their own community. Over the years, we've certainly learned to share content, and especially in news, but in terms of the shows that are run on a station day to day, that's chosen individually at each community.
So, is that going to change once KSTK is absorbed by Coast Alaska, rather than just being a member? Here's Sweat again.
For the listener or the user of the website, nothing's going to change. Nobody's going to notice anything different. So it's not going to be like one day we own it and we sound this way, and the next day somebody else owns it and we sound another way. That's not going to be the case.
But there will be changes in management. While two people from Wrangell will continue to sit on the Coast Alaska board as usual, KSTK's local board will no longer make decisions for the station. Instead, they will help with fundraising and community engagement. Angie Flickinger is the KSTK board president, and she says she'll be there for the station and staffers like Cindy Sweat.
And then also offer her whatever support she needs. So even though we won't be her boss anymore, you know, we can still kind of tap in where she needs us, since we've kind of filled that role before.
Transfer is pending FCC approval, which is expected for next month. In Wrangell, I'm June Loeffler.
New figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show Alaska had the highest rate of firearm deaths in the nation in 2016. There were 177 firearm-related deaths that year. That's a rate of about 23 firearm deaths per 100,000 residents, nearly double the national average. The figures show 113 of those deaths were suicides, while 51 were considered homicides or justified killings. Figures for 2017 are not yet available. Final results for 2016 show the nation's firearm death rate has risen each year since 2014, and the 2016 rate in Alaska only slightly higher than it was in 2015. Winter is off to a late start in parts of the rural parts of Alaska. Months of higher than normal temperatures have opened up dangerous holes in frozen rivers that many rural Alaskans use as roads. One troublesome ice highway is in the Kuskokwim River, where a man died on New Year's Eve after driving his snowmobile into a hole. Search and rescue teams in Bethel have been marking open holes on the Kuskokwim, but there are so many they ran out of reflective tape. Climatologists say the unseasonable warmth in parts of the state is a factor in making last month the warmest December on record for the entire state. Experts say the sustained warmth speaks of the continuing effects of climate change. Well, it is Friday, the 19th of January, 2018. Time to check in with Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors. He joins us on the phone line from Bellevue, Washington. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Joe.
More uncharted territory this week, huh?
You know, it only took 8 days to go from 25,000 to 26,000, and it was only 23 days, which was the previous record, from 24,000 to 25. So, you know, on a percentage basis, those changes aren't quite as big as they once were. But still, the milestones keep coming down as the economy perks along. and earnings are good. And so basically the theme for this week is what shut down? That's certainly the headlines on the political end, that the government may shut down due to lack of agreement about the budget. But it's not hurting markets. When it hurts the markets, we don't know. It did in years past when there was the same problem, at least briefly. But for the economy, the U.S. is just looking real good. There was a very interesting statistic this week on Thursday. Unemployment claims were at the lowest level for the week, for any week since 1973, 220,000. And we have a much larger population than we did in 1973. So it looks as though the employment situation continues to improve. And we also had a Beige Book report, which one of the Fed banks issues, sort of a survey of how things are looking in different Fed districts. And it was a very nice report, so the economy perks along. Over in the EU, as we've been discussing, their economy is doing as well as ours these days, which is a big change. And what is also doing well is the euro. And so if any of you are traveling to Europe anytime soon, you'll notice things are more expensive. The U.S. dollar is now at a three-year low vis-a-vis the European currency. Over in Asia, we had a final GDP report from China for 2017, and they clocked in at an official rate, which some people don't quite believe, but the official rate is 6.9%, and that is a bit better than expected. However, it is expected that the Chinese economy will be one of those that are slowing this coming year. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed at 26,071. That is a 3% gain, another solid gain. The Dow Jones at 7,336, that's a 2.8% gain. Another interesting statistic for stocks. The NASDAQ this week surpassed the inflation-adjusted record that it previously was. So if you look at, if you adjust your stock prices for inflation, it's taken 18 years to get to this point since the big bubble that we had in 1999 and 2000. The S&P closed at 2810. That was a 2.4% gain. Oil continues to hang in there above $60 a barrel, closed at $63.56 for West Texas, next month's delivery, as opposed to $64.34 last week. There is some expectation, however, that U.S. production will rise in response to this and perhaps put a lid or lower prices. We'll see. And gold is unchanged at $1,331 an ounce.
Okay, how about bonds?
Okay, now I'm going to say something which is a little surprising. I think less than the stock market, the big news was actually in the bond market this week. The 10-year Treasury, in response to good economic news around the world, particularly in Europe, closed at 2.63, and that is the highest it's been in 3 years. And a lot of commentators believe that the stock market will probably get some indigestion at some point as interest rates rise. We don't know when that will be. The 30-year is at 2.91. And we also have a 10-year high in the 2-year bond. The Treasury is at 2.05. And so we'll see if global growth stokes wages and inflation and hence bond yields.
Dan, indigestion, is that because people would be pulling their money out of stocks and putting them in bonds as the rate rises?
Yes, yes. Yeah, and there's also economic fallout from rising rates. It costs more money to buy, to invest, if you're a company at higher rates. And there is some competition, definitely. And also when you value stocks, the discount rate you use, to decide what a company is worth, the values theoretically come down also as interest rates rise.
Okay. All right. Well, what companies were announcing their earnings this past week?
Well, let's start with a non-earnings report from General Electric, which is really kind of disconcerting. GE slid down 13% to $16.26. Just when you think it can't get any worse for this company, it does. They announced a $6.2 billion loss from their insurance operations, and they're going to write off an additional whopping $22 billion over the next 5 years from their insurance business, some of which they've discontinued. And so now for the first time in a long time, people are saying, well, maybe we should just break up the company altogether. And so we'll see what happens with good old GE. United Health, symbol UNH, largest health insurer, had solid earnings. That closed at $243.35. Goldman Sachs, symbol GS, had sort of a mixed report. They made good money in some areas, but not in trading. And they also had a fairly large write-off of their tax benefits that were on the books. So GS closed at 256.12. Bank of America, symbol BAC, closed at 31.72. Good operating numbers from B of A. Apple, symbol AAPL, closed at 178.50, close to the high. They announced a repatriation of somewhere between $200 and $250 billion over the next 5 years. And this has to do with the change in tax law. And they are going to take some of that money and invest it in a new hub somewhere in the United States, which will be a fairly nice prize for whatever city gets that. I'm thinking back to the George W. Bush administration, where there was a similar tax change, at least for repatriation. And that really did have an effect on companies bringing back money. And Apple is certainly a case in point. Finally, Alaska Airlines, symbol ALK, closed at 68.88, continuing its slide from its so-so earnings report.
Okay, so for next week, you mentioned the possible government shutdown. What does anything shut down in the trading world if government is not open?
No.
Okay.
No, we just carry on.
So what?
And hope for the best.
What should we look for next week?
Well, next week, interestingly, the stuff we should be looking at closely is happening overseas. The Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank have their meetings. And what they have to say over there regarding what they're doing with their economic policy will certainly affect our markets and perhaps our interest rates. Also in the U.S., we have new and existing home sales, which are always interesting, manufacturing announcements with durable goods, too. So plenty of economic news. And then for company earnings, we have a lot. Just a few of the highlights: Netflix, Intel, 3M, Caterpillar, Verizon, Seattle-based Starbucks, Procter & Gamble, and Johnson & Johnson, among others. So far, we've had about 10% of the S&P 500 announced, and we'll get a lot more next week.
Okay, we'll talk to you next Friday. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Joe.
That's Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor and joins us on the phone from Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, a trade name used by Wells Fargo Clearing Services, LLC, member SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.